The entrance to the bridge fell backward. There was suddenly nothing behind it, and vanished before it hit the ground with a weak pop. A faint ripple spread out across the high grass. The boy and his mother sat on the dead bike, staring. Bats shrilled softly in the dark. Vic felt very easy in her mind. She was not sure there was much of anything left in there now, except for love, and that was enough. She drove her heel into the Kickstarter. The Triumph sighed its regrets. She tried again, felt things tearing inside her, spit more blood. A third time. The Kickstarter almost refused to go down, and the bike made no sound at all. "What's wrong with it, Mama?" Wayne asked in his new, soft, little boy's voice. She wiggled the bike back and forth between her legs. It creaked gently, but otherwise made no other sound. Then she understood and laughed. A dry, weak laugh, but genuine. "Out of gas," she said. Come All Ye Faithful, October. Gun Barrel. Wayne woke on the first Sunday in October to the clash of church bells pealing down the block. His father was there, sitting on the edge of the bed.
"What were you dreaming?"
his new, almost thin father asked him. Wayne shook his head. "I don't know. I don't remember," he lied.
"I thought maybe you were dreaming about Mom," Nulu said. "You were smiling."
"I guess I must have been thinking about something fun."
"Something fun or something good?" Nulu asked,
watching him with his curious Nulu eyes, inquisitive and bright,
"because they aren't always the same."
"I don't remember anymore," Wayne told him. Better to say that than to say he'd been dreaming about Brad McCauley and Marta Grigorski and the other children in Christmasland. Not that it was Christmasland anymore. It was just the white now. It was just the furious white static of a dead channel, and the children ran in it, playing their games. Last night's game had been called Bite the Smallest. Wayne could still taste blood. He moved his tongue around and around inside the sticky socket of his mouth. In his dream, he'd had more teeth.
"I'm taking the tow," Lou said. "Got a piece of work needs doing. You want to come with me? You don't have to. Tabitha could stay here with you."
"Is she here? Did she sleep over?"
"No, no," Lou said. He seemed genuinely surprised by the idea. "I just mean I could call her and have her come by."
His brow furrowed in concentration, and after a moment he went on, speaking more slowly.
"I don't think I'd feel okay about that right now. A sleepover. I think that would be strange for everyone."
Wayne thought the most interesting part of this statement was the right now part, implying that his father might feel okay about a sleepover with Miss Tabitha Hutter at some later date, TBD. 3 nights ago, they had all come out of a movie. They did that now sometimes, went to movies together. And Wayne had looked back in time to see his father take Tabitha Hutter by the elbow and kiss the corner of her mouth. The way she'd inclined her head and smiled slightly, Wayne understood that it was not their first kiss. It was too casual, too practiced. Then Tabitha had seen Wayne looking and slipped her arm free of Lou's hand.
"It wouldn't bother me," Wayne said. "I know you like her. I like her, too."
Lou said, "Wayne, your mom was, I mean, saying she was my best friend doesn't even begin to, but now she's dead, and you should be happy. You should have fun," Wayne said. Lou eyed him gravely, with a kind of sorrow, Wayne thought.
"Well," Lou said, "I'm just saying, you can stay here if you want. Tabitha is right down the street. I can have her here in 3 minutes. You gotta love a babysitter who comes with her own Glock."
"No, I'll keep you company. Where did you say we're going?"
"I didn't," Lou said.
Tabitha Hutter came by anyway, unannounced, buzzing up to the apartment while Wayne was still in his pajamas. She did that on occasion, came by with croissants, which she said she would trade for coffee. She could have bought coffee, too, but she claimed she liked the way Lou made it. Wayne knew an excuse when he heard one. There wasn't anything special about Lou's coffee,
unless you like your brew with an aftertaste of WD-40. She had transferred to the Denver office to assist in the ongoing McQueen investigation, a case in which no charges had been filed or ever would be filed. She had an apartment in Gun Barrel and usually ate with Lou and Wayne once a day, ostensibly to talk about what Lou knew. Mostly, though, they talked about Game of Thrones. Lou had finished reading the first book right before he went in for his angioplasty and his gastric bypass, which were performed at the same time. Tabitha Hutter was there when Lou woke up, the day after the surgery. She said she wanted to make sure he lived to read the rest of the series. "Hey, kids," Tabitha said. "You sneaking out on me?" "There's a job needs doing," Lou said. "On Sunday morning?" "People fuck up their cars then, too." She yawned into the back of her hand, a small, frizzy-haired woman in a faded Wonder Woman t-shirt and blue jeans. No jewelry, no accessories whatsoever. Aside from the 9mm strap to her hip. "Okay, make me a cup of coffee before we go?" Lou half-smiled at this but said, "You don't have to come. This could take a while." She shrugged. "What else am I going to do with myself? Outlaws like to sleep in. I've been FBI for 8 years, and I've never once had cause to shoot anyone before 11 in the morning. Not as long as I get my coffee, anyway." Lou got a dark roast brewing and went to start the truck, Tabitha following him out the door. Wayne was alone in the hall, pulling on his sneakers, when the phone rang. He looked at it sitting in its black plastic cradle on an end table just to his right. It was a few minutes past 7, early for a call, but maybe it was about the job they were getting ready to go off on. Maybe whoever had ditched his car was being helped by someone else. It happened. Wayne answered. The phone hissed, loud roar of white noise. "Wayne," said a breathy girl with a Russian accent, "when are you coming back? When are you coming back to play?" Wayne couldn't answer. His tongue sealed to the roof of his mouth, his pulse ticking in his throat. It wasn't the first time they had called. "We need you. You can't rebuild Christmasland. You can't take it all back. All the rides, all the shops, all the games. There's nothing to play with here. You have to help us. With Mr. Manx gone, there's only you." Wayne heard the front door open. He hit end. As Tabitha Hutter stepped into the hallway, he was setting the phone back in its cradle. "Someone call?" she asked, a kind of calm innocence in her gray-green eyes. "Wrong number," Wayne said. "I bet the coffee is done." Wayne wasn't okay, and he knew it. Kids who were okay did not answer phone calls from children who had to be dead. Kids who were okay didn't dream dreams like his. But neither of these things, not the phone calls or the dreams, were the clearest indicators that he was not okay. No. What really marked him out as not okay was the way he felt when he saw a photo of a plane crash, charged, jolted by excitement and guilt, as if he were looking at pornography. He had been driving out with his father the week before and had seen a chipmunk run in front of a car and get squashed, and he had barked with sudden surprised laughter. His father had snapped his head around and looked at Wayne with hollow-eyed wonder, had pursed his lips to speak but then said nothing, silenced perhaps by the ill look of shock and unhappiness on Wayne's face. Wayne didn't want to think it was funny, a little chipmunk zigging when it should have zagged, getting wiped out by someone's Goodyear. That was the kind of thing that made Charlie Manx laugh. He just couldn't help himself. There was the time he saw a thing about genocide in the Sudan on YouTube and had discovered a smile on his own face. There was a story about a little girl being kidnapped in Salt Lake City, a pretty 12-year-old blonde girl with a shy smile. Wayne had watched the news report in a state of rapt excitement, envying her. There was his recurring sense that he had 3 extra sets of teeth, hidden somewhere behind the roof of his mouth. He ran his tongue around and around his mouth and imagined he could feel them, a series of little ridges right under the flesh. He knew now that he had only imagined losing his ordinary boy teeth, had hallucinated this under the influence of the sevoflurane, just as he had hallucinated Christmasland. Lies! But his memory of those other teeth was more real, more vivid than the stuff of his everyday life. School, trips to the therapist, meals with his dad and Tabitha Hutter. He felt sometimes that he was a dinner plate that had cracked down the middle and then been glued back together. And the two parts did not quite line up. One side, the side of the plate that marked his life before Charlie Manx, was microscopically out of true with the other part of the plate. When he stood back and looked at that crooked plate, he could not imagine why anyone would want to keep it. It was no good now. Wayne did not think this with any despair. And that was part of the problem. It had been a long time since he'd felt anything like despair. At his mother's funeral, he had very much enjoyed the hymns. The last time he saw his mother alive, they were rolling her on a gurney toward the back of an ambulance. The paramedics were in a hurry. She had lost a great deal of blood. They would eventually pump 3 liters into her, enough to keep her alive for the night. But they were too slow to deal with the perforated kidney and intestine, not aware that her system was boiling with her body's own poisons. He had jogged alongside her, holding her hand. They were in the gravel parking lot of a general store, down the road from the ruin of Manx's lodge. Later, Wayne would learn that his mother and father had held their very first conversation in that parking lot. "You're okay, kiddo," Vic said to him. She was smiling, although her face was spattered with blood and filth. There was an oozing wound over her right eyebrow, and she had a breathing tube stuck up her nose. "Gold don't come off. What's good stays good, no matter how much of a beating it takes. You're okay? You'll always be okay." He knew what she was saying. She was saying he wasn't like the children in Christmasland. She was saying he was still himself. But Charlie Manx had said something different. Charlie Manx said blood didn't come out of silk. Tabitha Hutter had a first tentative sip of her coffee and glanced out the window over the kitchen sink. "Your dad has the truck out front. Grab a jacket in case it's cold. We should go." "Let's ride," Wayne said. They squeezed together into the tow truck, Wayne sitting in the middle. There was a time when all three of them wouldn't have fit, but new Lou didn't take up as much space as the old Lou. New Lou had a Boris Karloff in Frankenstein look, with gangly hanging arms and a collapsed stomach beneath the big barrel of his chest. He had Frankenstein scars to match, running up from under the collar of his shirt along the length of his neck and behind his right ear, where they had performed the angioplasty. In the wake of that and the gastric bypass, his fat had just melted away, like so much ice cream left in the sun. The most striking thing was his eyes. It didn't make sense that losing weight should change his eyes, but Wayne was more aware of them now, more conscious of his father's intense, questing gaze. Wayne settled into place beside his dad, then sat up to get away from something digging into his back. A hammer. Not an autopsy mallet, but just an ordinary carpenter's hammer, the wooden handle worn. Wayne set it next to his father's hip. The tow truck climbed away from Gun Barrel, following switchbacks through old firs, rising steadily into a spotless blue sky. Down in Gun Barrel it was warm enough in the direct rays of the sun, but up here the tops of the trees swished restlessly in a chill breeze that smelled fragrantly of the turning aspens. The slopes were streaked with gold. "And gold doesn't come off," Wayne whispered. "But just look, leaves were coming off all the time, whisking out across the road, sailing the breeze." "What did you say?" Tabitha asked. He shook his head. "How about some radio?" Tabitha asked, and reached past him to turn on some music. Wayne could not say why he preferred silence, why the idea of music made him apprehensive. Through a thin crackle of static, Bob Seger expressed his fondness for that old-time rock and roll. He averred that if anyone put on disco, he would be 10 minutes late for the door. "Where did this accident happen?" Tabitha Hutter asked. And Wayne noted distantly there was a faint note of suspicion in her voice. "We're almost there," Lou said. "Was anyone hurt?" Lou said, "This accident happened a while ago." Wayne didn't know where they were going until they passed the country store on the left. It wasn't a store anymore, of course, and hadn't been for a decade. The pumps remained out front, one of them blackened, the paint boiled off where it had caught fire the day Charlie Manx stopped for a fill. The hills above Gun Barrel had their share of abandoned mines and ghost towns, and there was nothing so remarkable about a lodge-style house with smashed windows and nothing inside except shadows and cobwebs.
"What do you have in mind, Mr. Carmody?" Tabitha Hutter asked.
"Something Vic wanted me to do," Lou said.
"Maybe you shouldn't have brought Wayne."
"Actually, I think maybe I shouldn't have brought you," Lou said. "I intend to tamper with evidence," Tabitha said.
"Oh, well, I'm off this morning."
He continued on past the general store. In half a mile, he began to slow. The gravel road to the sleigh house was on the right. As he turned in, the static rose in volume, all but erasing Bob Seger's grainy, affable voice. No one got good reception around the sleigh house. Even the ambulance had found it difficult to send a clear message to the hospital below. Something to do with the contours of the shelf rock, perhaps. It was easy in the notches of the Rockies to ride out of sight of the world below. And among the cliffs and the trees and the scouring winds, the 21st century was revealed to be only an imaginary construct, a fanciful notion that men had superimposed on the world, of no relevance whatsoever to the rock. Lou stopped the truck and got out to move aside a blue police sawhorse. Then they went on. The tow truck rattled across the washboarded dirt road, easing down almost to the dooryard of the ruin. The sumac was reddening in the fall chill. A woodpecker assaulted a pine somewhere. After New Lou put the truck into park, there was nothing coming from the radio but a roar of white noise. When Wayne shut his eyes, he could picture them. Those children of the static. Those children lost in the space between reality and thought. They were so close he could almost hear their laughter underneath the radio hiss. He trembled. His father put a hand on his leg, and Wayne opened his eyes and looked at him. Lou had slid down out of the truck but reached back into the cab to set a big hand on his knee. "It's okay," his father said. "This is all right, Wayne. You're safe." Wayne nodded, but his father misunderstood him. He wasn't afraid. If he was trembling, it was with nervous excitement. The other kids were so close, waiting for him to come back and dream into existence a new world, a new Christmas land with rides and food and games. It was in him to do this. It was in everyone. He needed something, some tool, some instrument of pleasure, of fun, that he could use to tear a hole out of this world and into his own secret inner landscape. Wayne felt the metal head of the hammer against his hip and looked at it and thought, "Maybe." Take the hammer and bring it down on the top of his father's head. When Wayne imagined the sound it would make, the deep, hollow knock of steel against bone, he tingled with pleasure. Take it to the center of Tabitha Hutter's pretty, round, smart, smug, bitch-cunt face, smash her glasses, smash the teeth right out of her mouth. That would be fun. The thought of her pretty full lips rimmed with blood gave him a frankly erotic charge. When he was done with them, he could go for a walk in the woods, back to the cliff face, where the brick tunnel to Christmasland had been. Take the hammer and hit the rock, swing the hammer until the stones split, until there was a fissure he could squeeze himself into, swing that hammer until he cracked the world open, made a space for him to crawl through, back into the world of thought, where the children waited. But while he was still thinking it over, fantasizing about it, his father removed his hand and took up his hammer. "Oh, what is this about?" Tabitha Hutter said under her breath, and undid her seatbelt and got out on her side. The wind soughed through the pines. Angels swayed. Silver globes refracted the light in brilliant polychromatic sprays. Lou stepped off the road, picking his way down the embankment. He lifted his head, he had just one chin now, and it was a good one, and turned his wise turtle stare on the ornaments in the branches. After a time, he picked one down, a white angel blowing a gold trumpet, set it on a rock, and smashed it with the hammer. There was a momentary squall of feedback amid the static on the radio. "Lou?" Tabitha asked, coming around the front of the truck, and Wayne thought if he slid behind the wheel and put it in drive, he could run her down. He imagined the sound of her skull striking the grill and started to smile. The idea was quite amusing, but then she moved on into the trees. He blinked rapidly to clear aside this awful, lurid, wonderful vision and jumped down out of the truck himself. The wind rose, tossed his hair. Lou found a glitter-spackled silver ornament, a globe as big as a softball, tossed it in the air, and swung the hammer like a baseball bat. The glittery sphere exploded in a pretty spray of opalescent glass and copper wire. Wayne stood close to the truck, watching. Behind him, through the loud roar of the static, he heard a children's choir singing a Christmas song. They sang about the faithful. Their voices were far away, but clear and sweet. Lou crushed a ceramic Christmas tree and a china plum sprinkled with gold glitter and several tin snowflakes. He began to sweat and removed his flannel coat. "Lou," Tabitha said again, standing at the top of the embankment, "why are you doing this?" "Because one of these is his," Lou said, and nodded at Wayne. "Thick brought most of him back, but I want the rest." The wind screamed. The trees lunged. It was a little frightening, the way the trees were beginning to pitch back and forth. Pine needles and dead leaves flew. "What do you want me to do?" Tabitha asked.
"Bare minimum, don't arrest me."
He turned away from her, found another ornament. It was crushed with a musical tinkling. Tabitha looked at Wayne. "I've never been one for just doing the bare minimum. You want to help? Looks like fun, doesn't it?" Wayne had to admit it did. She used the butt of her gun. Wayne used a rock. In the car, the Christmas choir rose and swelled until even Tabitha noticed it and pointed an uneasy, wondering glance back at the truck. Lou ignored it, though, continued crushing glass holly leaves and wire crowns. And in a few moments, the white noise rose again in a roar, burying the song. Wayne smashed angels with trumpets, angels with harps, angels with hands folded in prayer. He smashed Santa and all his reindeer and all his elves. At first he laughed. Then, after a while, it wasn't as funny. After a while, his teeth began to ache. His face felt hot, then cold, then so cold it burned, icy hot. He didn't know why, didn't give it much in the way of conscious thought. He was raising a blue chunk of shale to smash a ceramic lamb when he saw movement at the upper edge of his vision and lifted his head and spied a girl standing by the ruin of the sleigh house. She wore a filthy nightgown. It had been white once, but now was mostly rust-colored from smears of dried blood, and her hair was in tangles. Her pale, pretty face was stricken, and she was crying silently. Her feet were bloody. "Pomosch," she whispered. The sound of it was almost lost in the whistling wind. "Pomosch." Wayne had never heard the Russian word for help before, but understood well enough what she was saying. Tabitha saw Wayne staring, turned her head, spotted the girl. "Oh, my God," she said softly. "Lou, Lou." Lou Carmody stared across the yard at the girl, Marta Grigorsky, missing since 1991. She had been 12 when she disappeared from a hotel in Boston, and was 12 now, 20 years later. Lou regarded her with no particular surprise at all. He looked gray and tired, sweat slicking the loose flesh of his cheeks. "I have to get the rest, Tabby," Lou said. "Can you help her?" Tabitha turned her head and gave him a frightened, bewildered look. She holstered her gun, turned, and began to walk swiftly through the dead leaves. A boy came out of the brush behind Marta, a black-haired boy of 10, wearing the dirty blue and red uniform of a beef-eater. Brad McCauley's eyes were stricken, wondering, and terrified all at once. He cast a sidelong glance at Marta, and his chest began to hitch with sobs. Wayne swayed on his heels, staring at the two of them. Brad had been wearing his beef-eater outfit in his dream last night. Wayne felt light-headed, like sitting down, but the next time he rocked back on his heels, he was close to falling over. His father caught him from behind, set one massive hand on Wayne's shoulder. Those hands didn't quite go with his new Lou body, made his large, gawky frame look that much more badly put together. "Hey, Wayne," Lou said, "hey. You can wipe your face on my shirt if you want." "What?" Wayne asked. "You're crying, kiddo," Lou said. He held out his other hand. In it were ceramic shards, pieces of a smashed moon. "You've been crying for a while now. I guess this one was yours, huh?" Wayne felt his shoulders jerk in a convulsive shrug. He tried to answer, but couldn't force any sound from his tight throat. The tears on his cheeks burned in the cold wind, and his self-control gave way, and he buried his face in his father's stomach, missing for a moment the old Lou with his comforting, bearish mass. "I'm sorry," he whispered, his voice choked, strange. He moved his tongue around his mouth, but could not feel his secret teeth anymore. A thought that set off such an explosion of relief, he had to hang on to his father to keep from falling down. "I'm sorry, Dad. Oh, Dad, I'm sorry," his breath coming in short, jolting sobs. "For what?" "I don't know. Crying. I got snot on you," Lou said. "No one has to apologize for tears, dude." "I feel sick." "Yeah, yeah, I know. It's okay. I think you're suffering from the human condition." "Can you die from that?" Wayne said. "Yes," Lou said. "It's pretty much fatal in every case." Wayne nodded. "Okay, well, I guess that's good." Behind them, far away, Wayne could hear Tabitha Hutter's clear, steady, calming voice, asking names, telling children they would be all right, that she was going to take care of them. He had an idea, if he turned around, that he would see maybe a dozen of them now, and the rest were on their way, out of the trees, leaving the static behind. He could hear some of them sobbing. The human condition. It was contagious, apparently. "Dad," Wayne said, "if it's all right with you, can we skip Christmas this year?" Lou said, "If Santa tries to come down our chimney, I'll send him back up with my boot in his ass. It's a promise." Wayne laughed. It sounded much like a sob. That was all right. Out on the highway, there was the ferocious roar of an approaching motorcycle. Wayne had an idea, a desperate, awful idea, that it was his mother. The children had all come back from something like death, and perhaps it was her turn. But it was just some dude out on the road, taking his Harley for a spin. It blasted past with a deafening roar, sun glinting off chrome. It was early October, but in the strong, direct light of the morning sun, it was still warm. Fall was here, winter coming right behind it. But for now, there was still a little good riding weather left. Begun the 4th of July, 2009. Completed over the holidays, 2011. Joe Hill, Exeter, New Hampshire.
This is Kate Mulgrew. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged recording of Nosferatu by Joe Hill. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Recorded by Jared O'Connell. Music by Freddie Kaw. Executive producer, Karen Jakomsky. She is not related in any way to Paul Jakomsky, who went to Christmasland in 1968, and who escaped into the white with Millie Manx after the terrible Christmas Eve when Sugar Candy Mountain fell. After a long, timeless time, Millie led him and two more kids, Francine Flynn and Howard Hitchcock, out of the static and into the pines. They watched from back in the trees as the other children, quitters, came out of the forest, all of them carrying on, sobbing and poor meing, snot and tears all over their faces. Millie did a quiet imitation of the way they were weeping and snotting on themselves, and it was such good sport, Paul had to bite down with two rows of teeth to keep from laughing. They would settle with those kids later. Quitters were only good for one thing, being it in a game of scissors for the drifter or bite the smallest. But when the first ambulance turned onto the road to Sleigh House, they knew it was time to go. Millie led the other three to the blue spruce where their ornaments were hung together, well back from where Wayne Carmody, king of the quitters, was smashing decorations with his father. Each of Charlie's true children collected his or her own special ornament, and together they slipped away down the hill before they could be discovered. It was sad that Christmasland was gone. But there was no point in crying over spilled milk or cataclysmic avalanches. And besides, now the whole world is their playground. And it really doesn't matter if they can't live in an eternal Christmas anymore. After all, Christmas is just a state of mind. And as long as you keep a little holiday spirit in your heart, every day is Christmas Day. Text copyright 2013 by Joe Hill. Production copyright 2013 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Joe Hill, the author of Nosferatu, and I just wanted to thank you for listening to my book. And I really wanted to say a big thank you to Kate Mulgrew for such a tremendous reading. I first heard some of Kate's work as an audio reader when she read a short story of mine called By the Silver Waters of Lake Champlain. And I listened to her reading of it, and I just completely fell in love with it because I felt that she really squeezed every emotional nuance out of it that she could find, and that she understood each of the characters, and that she was having fun with the story. And I just think it was really wonderful of her to come back and read another story about the loss of innocence and childhood magic, but on a much larger scale. I don't know that Nosferatu had any one particular root or beginning. A lot of times for me, stories don't come from one seed, but are generated from a few different kernels that seem to grow together. One idea that I have been playing with for years as a writer is the idea that everybody actually lives in two worlds. There's the world of stuff, of coffee in the morning, and bad jobs, and bad hair, and work, and physics, and chemistry. And that's what we think of as life. That's the world you live in. But I actually think that people spend as much time living in the world of thought. And in the world of thought, emotions are as powerful and as real as gravity. And imagination is as powerful as physical law. And that world also really and truly exists. You could even make a philosophical argument that that world exists for us more than the real world. So I've always been fascinated by the idea that everyone has a foot in two worlds, and I've always been interested in the idea of bringing one world into the other, bringing the world of the imaginary into the world of the real. And Nosferatu was sort of my opportunity to explore that idea on a very wide, very large canvas. So Vic McQueen is what her friend Maggie calls a creative, a powerful creative, someone who can drag the imaginary into the world of the real. And Charlie Manx is also a powerful creative in his own awful way. But her creativity extends beyond her ability to generate this impossible bridge. She seeks a creative life. She's had her troubles and her emotional struggles, and her escape from that is this illustrated world she creates for a series of children's books called Search Engine. And in my own case, I'm something of a failed children's book author. I remember writing a book called The Grime Goblin about a little boy fascinated with vacuum cleaners. And eventually he gets one which is so powerful it sucks up his parents and sucks up all the furniture in his house. And eventually goes on a rampage and begins sucking the color right off the page of the children's book. And this was something I wrote up, and I tried to peddle to various publishers years and years ago. It never quite panned out, which is too bad, but I finally got a chance to scratch my children's book itch by writing about that craft in Nosferatu, and that was fun. I think a search engine children's book would be great. I dedicated the book to my mom for a lot of different reasons, in part because the book is about parenting and about how hard it is to be a mom, how hard it is to do the right thing by your little guys. And Vic is someone who is always trying to reach past her fears and her anger to be a good mom. It felt right to tie the book back to my own mom, who was the best of moms, who was creative and patient, and from whom I really learned how to be a parent. You know, I learned to keep the kids' fingernails clipped, their hair washed, their lunches made, and to try to respond to their emotions with humor and patience instead of anger. and frustration, because being a mom or a dad can be angry, frustrating work. So there's that. But the other thing is that I learned my mom is a great novelist, and I learned a lot about writing character from reading her books. And I've always struggled to show characters, to take my heroes and to paint them as decent, thoughtful, and imaginative people struggling to do the right thing in spite of their flaws and doubts. And I'm not a fan of storytelling where the heroes are doubly do-rights. And I think that real struggle has to involve internal struggle as well as any sort of exterior efforts to catch the bad guy and perform acts of heroism. So I learned a lot about writing character from reading my mom's work, and I think that that's seeded throughout my work, not just Nosferatu. I'm a guy who really prizes the imagination above all other personality traits. I do think that my decision to become a novelist is about the most unimaginative thing I ever could have done, but it was a very natural choice. Both my parents are writers. My mom is a novelist, my dad is a novelist. And I would come home from school when I was 12, and I would find each of them in their office clattering away at the keyboard, playing make-believe for a living. And that seemed like a pretty good way to collect a paycheck. So by the time I was in sixth grade, I was also writing every day. I would just get home and go up to my room and roll a sheet of paper into my IBM Selectric typewriter and bang out a few pages of fiction, because it seemed like what you were supposed to do. And I think in close-knit families, in loving families, it's not all that surprising when the kids look at the lives their parents shape for themselves and say, that looks pretty good. I think maybe I'd like to try my hand at that. And I also think that there are traditions of family craftsmanship. Maine is home to the Wyeth family, and there you see generation after generation of technically accomplished and very creative illustrators who have done fine art and have also done great art for adventure stories and fantasy and gothic stories, and just they're an amazing set of illustrators. And I think that what you see there is a close family that had some skills to share with each other. So maybe it's not a big surprise that I became a writer, and my younger brother, Owen King, is also a very accomplished novelist. He wrote a book called Double Feature, which is just out, and it's just about the funniest book I've ever read. So it's a family thing, but I feel pretty good about it because I feel that when I'm writing a story, I'm engaging in a conversation I've been having with my parents and my brother and sister since I was little, and it's a pretty good conversation. I've always been a fan of recorded stories, of audiobooks. I know that the noted critic Harold Bloom has said that listening isn't the same as reading. And as Neil Gaiman has noted, that would be a shock to John Milton, who was blind and had everything read to him by his daughters. According to Harold Bloom, Milton had no experience of literature. I think that being told a story is one of the most natural human experiences you can come by, and a well-read audiobook is a special literary treasure. And I've listened to unabridged audio since I was little. Some of that was what happened within the family. It sounds very 19th century, but after dinner, my family would go in the living room and sit around and pass a book. We'd read a book together. I remember reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that way. And those were great nights, special experiences. Later in my teens, I remember listening to Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry and being completely immersed in that world and laughing and feeling every emotional jolt down in my nerve endings, and it was just a terrific reading that completely swept me away. Years later, I listened to another book on tape. I listened to The Fixer by Bernard Malamud, and that instantly became my favorite novel ever, and it's the story of a Jewish carpenter just before the Russian Revolution who's in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And I loved that story, and up until I read The Fixer, probably Lonesome Dove was my favorite book. And years later, I thought back on it, and they're very different stories, and it didn't quite make sense that I would love both so passionately. And one day I realized that both books had been read by the same reader, the late Wolfram Kandinsky. And the readings couldn't have been more different, but it was the same voice. And that was a voice that spoke directly to the deepest part of my imagination, and absolutely is one of the reasons why I love those books so much. So I think when you find a great reader who can do something special, like Kate Mulgrew, you're in for an experience that will last with you for a long, long time and can be very satisfying and can make a good book that much better. So, yeah, I mean, I'm all for audiobooks and routinely listen to, you know, half a dozen books on audio a year. So what are some of my favorite audiobooks that are still available? Let me see if I can give you a few recommendations. I'm an enormous fan of the crime novelist Elmore Leonard, who has written now, I think, 5 decades of unforgettable stories. And because so much of what Elmore Leonard does is built around his electrifying dialogue, there's a lot to recommend the audiobooks that have been made out of his stories. And in particular, I would single out Arliss Howard's reading of The Hut Kid. It's one of Elmore Leonard's best, and the reading is dry and witty and smart and a terrifically exciting experience. So The Hut Kid, read by Arliss Howard, is one that I would recommend. There are a variety of readers who jump in to read Shadow Show, which is a collection honoring the late Ray Bradbury. And there's a whole mix of voices on that one. And I feel that all those different voices are as varied as the sort of emotional experiences you could get from reading Ray Bradbury's stories. That's a really interesting grab bag of readings. And among them is Kate Mulgrew's reading of By the Silver Waters of Lake Champlain, which I just think is a terrific, terrific reading. And if you enjoyed her reading of Nosferatu, you'll want to leap right over for that because that's great fun.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.